Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the... Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, it's pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Your home is important. That's why GEICO helps make it easy to save on condo insurance. Because home is more than just a place. Home is where you took minimalism too far because there's only one chair in your entire condo and your only entertainment is one card. Not even a deck of cards, but a single card. And all your guests have to share one plate and one fork, but you're convinced that less stuff means more freedom. The GEICO Insurance Agency could help protect the overly minimalist broom closet you call home. Call GEICO and see how easy it is to switch and save on condo insurance.
Hey guys, what's going on? You are listening to ThisWeekInGeek.net's Botched Roll. That's right guys, I brought this back from the dead. It has succeeded at save versus death. And we are checking out something new and exciting here on the show this week. Now, normally I'd be talking about a topic of interest in the role-playing community, either to make yourself a better game master, things to make you perhaps a better player to your game master, or other topics that thereof. But today I actually have something kind of special. As you guys know, sometimes I get a chance to talk with people in the RPG industry to talk about their experiences, their jobs, but also just what makes them tick as role-playing geeks and nerds much like ourselves. So today I want to welcome to the show Modiphius Entertainment's Sam Webb, and he's the line developer for Star Trek, which is a show they've been playing over on Terrible Warriors, and it's something we'll probably take a look at Cambridge Chronicles eventually at some point down the road, but without...
I can't believe it.
That Gerald is presenting the quarterly budget report with finger puppets?
Look, here comes a 1.7% decrease in fixed overhead! Hello, everybody!
No, I can't believe how easy it was to save hundreds of dollars on my car insurance with GEICO.
Who are you? The projected increase in organic Q3 revenue. Hooray!
Believe it, GEICO could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Without any further ado, I want to welcome Sam to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
I am doing fantastic. Sam, thank you for taking time out of, I'm sure, is a ridiculously busy schedule to speak with us here on This Week in Geek.
It's a great respite. Thanks very much for having me.
Of course. So let's get started right away and let's sort of break it down to what is your RPG cred? So you are the line developer for Star Trek, but that's not something they just hand you a job title and you just do it right away. You had to start somewhere. So let's get into your history, your origin story, your backstory. Tell me, who is Sam Webb? Where did you begin with the RPG world at large? Like, did you start playing in high school? Did you play before that?
Yeah, well, you say they don't hand it out to anybody, but I kind of grabbed it from nowhere. So I started Modiphius Entertainment as Chris, who's our publishing director's assistant, and that was just helping him manage stuff day to day, wrangling projects, management of those projects and the people that are working for those. And there was an opportunity came along with Star Trek, and I kind of basically said to him, well, I've been doing this kind of management stuff for it for a month or so now. Can I go into this properly full time? And he was like, well, so long as it doesn't interfere with your other work. And so I went, well, sure. And then slowly Star Trek Adventures just became all of my work. So I kind of sidelined my way into it somehow. But I started playing, and I know there are going to be boos at home, 4th Ed D&D.
Wow.
Quite enjoyed it, in all honesty. It still holds a little place in my heart. But then from there, actually, what I was doing at the time was I was a student at a drama college here in London. So I was studying to be a theatre director. So I had some, when I came into Modiphius, I had some creative kind of training under my belt. And when it comes to theatre, at least, as film as well, but I don't know it so much. What you're doing as a director is you're also almost kind of managing a team of creative people, which is essentially what I'm doing as a line developer, is that I'm just kind of managing artists, writers, editors, all those people that all are working on kind of different parts of the game. as well as really rules developers. And they all want to see it be this awesome thing, but they've all got their own specific role. But you do need that person who's got kind of oversight on the whole thing to just, you know, get all the threads and tie them all together. So that's essentially what I was doing. And then I also basically kind of saw it into production. So that's liaising with printers and getting it into print and then getting it into distribution and stores as well.
So one of the other things that I've read about by doing a little bit of research on you, and this is something that I've dabbled in myself, and since I hear in your discussion there that you're a theater geek, you used to do live action role play once upon a time.
I still do live action role playing.
Well, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I actually just came away from a weekend where I was playing an undercity beggar in a shanty town. As a kind of spy character in a way, like a kind of gossip monger, I guess. And that's got very kind of threads of Vermintide, a little bit of Warhammer to it as a theme. But you're almost playing the kind of down and out NPCs that you see as a kind of adventurer player character walking out of town. You see those kind of scruffy guys that sell you potions on the edge of town. And that's what we were playing. But I also have for a number of years now helped run a couple of live role play games here in the UK, one of them called Wasteland UK, which is a very Fallout Book of Eli inspired kind of live role play game where essentially it's been a nuclear apocalypse and you're playing in that post-apocalypse world with kind of some government conspiracies, picking up the pieces, as well as just trying to survive day to day. And then we've also got a fairly new game called Folk, which is a kind of modern day fairy tale and folklore story where the kind of the veil has been pulled back and the characters that come along are, you know, modern day people, but they become aware of the fae and magic. And so they try to reconcile that with also trying to save the world from kind of an eldritch influence. So, yeah, I still do that. And there's a lot of parallels to draw between live role play and theatre, which, you know, I've heard LARP affectionately described as a cross-country pantomime. And if the American audience isn't aware, kind of pantomimes are a very famous UK tradition where it's kind of a really stupid, silly play that happens every Christmas in pretty much every theatre up and down the country. So, yeah, I still do that. And I think it has influenced a lot of my tabletop RPG work as well, because when you're writing, say, an adventure or something, when you're GMing, you're not necessarily just writing, okay, the players are going to go here, then they're going to do this, then they're going to go on to this, and that's when I reveal this, and then they are going to do that. And then because they never do. They do, you know, X, Y, Z. They go off and buy a new tools, or they go off and talk to the wrong NPC. So actually what you're doing is kind of establishing all of the what I call given circumstances of the adventure, and then depending on your style, I guess you're kind of playing in more of a sandbox, and you have to do that a lot with live role play because essentially anything could happen. So you have a bunch of characters who all have their own agency, and you have to just be prepared to roll with the punches. So you can plan as well as you like, but you know, the player characters might drag you off in a completely different direction.
Absolutely. That's something I've definitely found is where if they don't want to necessarily go down the plot railroad, they'll find a way to get off the boxcar and go off the reservation, such as it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you started working on Star Trek, obviously this is a property that has ridiculously huge fan base. It's got people that know the canon inside and out. Was that intimidating to take on as a line developer? Because that's a huge responsibility.
It didn't feel that intimidating. I guess I didn't really think about it like that. I've been a Star Trek fan for my life. I think a lot of people can empathize with this, that I've been sat in the same armchair, like literally, you know, thigh to thigh with my dad, sat there kind of, you know, watching Captain Picard at the time, and then on to DS9 and Voyager as well. So I grew up with it. And so I already felt a closeness to the IP and the source material. So I guess, you know, Star Trek is in a book. I felt okay with that, but I also had a lot of support from people. We got a lot of knowledgeable writers and a lot of knowledgeable editors helping us as well. So my kind of what I call my my number one is Jim Johnson. He's the line editor on it, and he's a published Star Trek fiction writer. So he's written some books, kind of like on a kind of an expanded universe kind of thing. So while not canon, they kind of, you know, they exist out there in memory beta as things that happen. So that was also material for more than I think I ever would, even if I watched every single episode, everything ever again. And then we also had help from Scott Pearson, who we call our canon editor. And he's been an editor for Simon & Schuster for a number of years now on Star Trek fiction. And he is just an encyclopedia of information. It's absolutely crazy what he remembers. I remember getting a draft back from one of my writers that he'd reviewed, and he actually had a comment in part of their manuscript that said, "Now, if you're talking about this thing, make sure you mention it happened in this half of this specific year, because otherwise, if you talk about the first half of the year, it doesn't really apply." And I'm like, "What? How do you know that level of detail?" And he's talking about some obscure Klingon thing. And I'm like, what? That's crazy. But I mean, look, the interesting thing that I do say to fans when they talk to me about this kind of, you know, specificity with the source material and how, you know, oh, if you get something wrong, you know, we'll be very careful. It's, you know, we go through approvals with CBS. But I mean, look, essentially, they're on our side and they want us to be creative as well. And the thing is, Star Trek canon in and of itself has never really tied up with itself. You know, everything has always gone at plot speed. The Dominion seemed to sweep across both the Alpha and Beta Quadrant in ridiculous speeds. And it just, as I think with CBS particularly, it's the story and the, you know, I'd say the human experience that matters, rather than making sure that it's been exactly 6 days between these two planets in journey time, you know? So the approvals in and of themselves, whilst, you know, they want us to be very specific and you know, basically obey the kind of canon of the TV shows and the movies, they trust us enough, I think, that we've been allowed to have a little bit of artistic license with things.
So with that, because you can do so much with CBS's approval, plus you have people helping you from the lines and even people helping you from Star Trek Online, what is some of the creative stuff that you've been able to bring out? As you said, you have artistic license. What's some of the things that's uniquely Modiphius has made for this? Like maybe it's an NPC, maybe a ship class or anything thereof.
Sure. Well, apart from the kind of various NPC stats that we've made for the canon characters, either for the bridge crews of the actual TV shows or for, say, you know, key characters, named characters that get kind of, you know, our guest stars in one or two episodes. We also have our living campaign area called the Shackleton Expanse. And we basically, if any of you, your listeners, have seen our little galaxy map of the Alpha and Beta Quadrants, they'll have seen this massive yellow area off to the right of the Beta Quadrant. And basically, that's our playground. We have license to do effectively whatever we want in that area. And that's where our living campaign takes place, like I said. So we've got a kind of branching, evolving campaign that's informed by player action that we release every couple of months or so, new episodes of. And we've got our own big kind of meta plot going on in that area, as well as having enough source material to allow players to, you know, have their own adventures out in that area. So CBS has been very nice in kind of letting us carve out a portion of the galaxy to just kind of stick our flag in and then, you know, kind of do what we like with, which is really cool.
So with the living campaign, like I said, it does have this evolving kind of meta plot. So far, I think you've had two or three instances of it so far. What's the part of it that you're the most proud of so far?
I think players are yet to see what I'm most proud of yet. We're writing a season finale for this one. I think we're on about wave 6 or 7 of the adventures. So we've had at least 6 missions for each era. And actually, well, what, you know, one thing that I am quite proud of, actually, that people have seen is that what we're doing is to kind of not two timelines, but two kind of two time periods. So we've got missions that come out in parallel, but they're both for, one of them's for 2269, so it's in the original series era. And then the other mission comes out for 2371, which is the next generation kind of slash DS9 era. And what's happening is that these two plots are kind of informing each other. So, you know, you might think that what you're doing affects your kind of plot line in isolation. But actually what happens in the original series will influence what people can do in the next generation era, for example. But the thing that's coming up, if people can spot it, it's a really little beautiful little Easter egg that I don't really want to spoil for people. But if they follow if they follow the season finale closely enough, hopefully they can kind of go back to the books and join the dots on that.
That's fantastic. I know on our sister show, Terrible Warriors, they've been playing the Living Campaign. I think they just played Signals. Was the last one they reported, or at least that's what he called it anyway.
Yeah, Signals is a kind of a big standout adventure for us, and it's, to be honest, it's the one I always go to run if someone goes, oh Sam, will you run Star Trek for us? Like, you know, I know it well enough now that it's in the quick start too, so I can get it over in a night. I know the plot and I can run it pretty effectively, and it's a favorite little mission of mine that we've written so far. So I'm really proud of that one as well.
Now, speaking of running Star Trek, I myself have not had a chance to play it myself, and I've had it described to me as a different type of RPG. How would you describe Star Trek's system and its mechanics compared to something like, say, D&D? Because I know Star Trek has a focus on problem solving as opposed to whipping out the phaser and shooting it in the face.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, interesting enough, one of our mechanics in the game we call extended tasks. And that basically, at its kind of fundamental level, it's like applying hit points to a problem. So you're trying to do some injuries to the problem, essentially, by getting more than 5 damage dealt to it at once. And once you've done enough injuries to it, or what we call breakthroughs, then you've actually like resolved the problem. So one thing I did that we haven't published, but I did at home with my home group, was I basically showed them a kind of star system, and I went, well, something's really odd about this star system. The probe says one thing and your telemetry says another. So the two scientific characters, the con officer and the science officer, took it upon themselves to do an extended task, and I kind of bounced back between them and the other people in the party or in the crew. But they were kind of developing through the breakthroughs and were getting more information from me, I was kind of expanding on what their theories could be and what happened. But also, interestingly, what they can do is they do what we use a scientific method in Star Trek as well. So basically, we kind of put the agency in players' hands and go, well, okay, well, there is this observation. You have seen this thing happen. What do you think is going on? So you apply one of your kind of specialist topics that you know, say you know about quantum mechanics or something. So you apply that to the problem and you go, well, maybe it's doing something on a quantum level. And out of these different hypotheses, then they start rolling some dice and we start trying to get breakthroughs through the extended task. And actually, it's really cool because you can say, well, actually, by getting this breakthrough, you can say that you're not on the right path. Or they might have an idea that you hadn't thought of, but it's so cool and out of the box that you just go, do you know what? Yep, it's that one. I like that one better. I'm going with that. So it rewards investigation and discovery, just like Star Trek has at its kind of core ethos, I think. So it's less what I'd call goblin bothering, and it's more, you know, going out there and finding things out and investigating and trying to work for things peacefully.
So kind of like, for example, in my roleplay experience, I would consider similar to, say, Gumshoe or Call of Cthulhu, where being a scholar, in this case a scientist in Star Trek, is definitely helping you figure out problems as opposed as, like you said, being a murder hobo, just going through and swinging like a sword at it. And that's something that I do like about Star Trek, that it does allow you to do more investigative, more scientific things. So if you're a science nerd, even if you're not, you can create interesting scenarios and interesting outcomes for your player group.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've always said to the people at my tables that, you know, you don't have to know Star Trek to enjoy this game when I'm running it. You don't have to know scientific things when, you know, because writers can research stuff on Wikipedia or on different, you know, scientific websites and stuff. And, you know, they'll get a perfect handle on it. So the GM might know loads, but the player that sat there who's not scientifically minded might go, oh, well, you know, I don't know what really to do. And I always say to my engineer at home, like, dude, just tell me what you want to do or tell me how you want to fix it. I don't need to know the Trekno babble or the ins and outs. You just, if you say, I want to fix it, we'll do it, you know. So, I, you know, we don't also don't want to kind of exclude those people who don't know too much about it either.
Absolutely, because I know when we run Star Trek on the Cambridge Chronicles, which is, like I said, the sister show to Terrible Warriors, one of our guys I know is not a Trekkie, but he loves science material. So it'll be interesting to see how this all kind of plays out, because I have a very interesting idea for a campaign, which I'm totally going to run past you when we're done this interview. So with Star Trek this year, you've had several big book releases. You've had the Beta Quadrant come out. You've had the Command Division just came out a little while ago. What other books are in the pipeline for this year?
So right now I'm working on the Operations Division supplement, and that's going to basically do what the Command Division did for the Ops Division. So it's going to have stuff on engineering and security. It's going to have new equipment and technology as a chapter. Also some new kind of science, security and engineering focused NPCs. And then in the back of the book, it's also going to have our red alert rules, which are basically, it's like kind of stripping back the some of the complexity of the combat mechanics and applying it to a little miniatures game. So you can use the tiles, you can use our resin miniatures with it to just kind of, you know, if two of you are the only ones that turn up for the group that week, you can go, well, do you know what? I'll take the Enterprise, you take the Klingons, let's just have a fight and let's just, you know, let's have some fun. So it's quite kind of beer and pretzels in that sense. But it allows you to also, as a GM, if you want to, basically break out from the kind of fairly individualist mechanics of combat and, you know, start using whole squads of people so you can get a kind of first contact, Borg have taken over the ship kind of feeling to your game, you know. Then, I mean, that is going to be this year. And then I think early next is going to next be the Science Division supplement. And we're not going to go with the Alpha next. We're going to go with Science instead. Because you know, we think, you know, get those kind of player orientated supplements out there first, because, you know, you're gonna want to have a more kind of rounded experience before getting out the source material, I think. So Alpha Quadrant will follow after that, as well as the Gamma and Delta Quadrant books. We've also got the starter set coming for Christmas, so you know, if anyone like yourself who's interested but hasn't necessarily got the book yet, and you fancy it, then the starter set's perfect, because it gives you some dice. It gives you basically the starter rule set, so a little bit more than the quick start, but it also gives you a 3-mission little mini campaign to play through, which has its own brilliant plot. But not only that, it actually kind of teaches you the game as you go along. So there's a lot of guidance in there for game masters who are either fairly new to role playing or who don't know the 2D20 system, to kind of guide them through the mechanics and then basically get them playing by mission two.
I got to say, the book I'm looking the most forward to, and this will identify me immediately as a Voyager dork, I'm looking forward most to the Delta Quadrant book, because I think the Star Trek Voyager added so much to the lore of Star Trek, and just being able to play in that backyard in particular, I'm really, really interested in. So I'm looking forward to that book next year, plus especially Science, as that's always sort of my jam, is playing Science and medical people whenever I played the Decipher and even the old FOSSA rules, so way back in the day. So I guess, Sam, as my final question to you, what is something you'd like to tell... Hold on, let me... I'm trying to figure out just the right way to phrase this.
I wonder where this is going.
I want this to be a real hammer question, something really, really, really surprising. Okay.
All right.
Will there ever be Modifius and CBS approved licensed products in Star Trek that you currently have right now, will we ever see you guys touch the Kelvin timeline or Discovery?
So Kelvin, we don't have the license for. So while we don't touch on that, the book in of itself and the game doesn't really limit you from exploring that if you want to. So while we don't have any published source material on that, there's no reason you can't just delve into it. Much like it's a parallel timeline, it's still Star Trek. It just maybe has a few more lens flares and punching, but you know, it's still Star Trek. And it's the same for the different eras as well. So there's no reason why you can't play Enterprise or Original Series or Next Generation, even though the book is styled in the Elcars kind of format. There will be an Original Series product coming out in the future. That's all I'll say on that. But there really isn't anything kind of stopping you on that.
Well, I tried, guys. But Sam, I gotta thank you for taking time out of your ridiculously busy schedule to talk with us here on Botstroll and This Week in Geek.
No problem, my pleasure.
All right, guys, that was my interview with Sam Webb, the line developer for Modiphius's Star Trek role-playing game. I really recommend you check this out. If you want to hear how they're playing the living campaign, go check out Terrible Warriors, which is the sister show to Cambridge Chronicles. They are playing through that right now with Justin and his crew. We will be playing this on the... on Cambridge Chronicles at some point, likely in the new year. We're still trying to plan that out right now, but be sure to be staying tuned for that. So anyway, guys, coming up on Botstroll in the next little while, I did have some ideas for topics that were suggested by you from Twitter. Most of the topics that I've been asked to cover is how to DM, picking your first RPG, the licensed RPG, which we just talked about today, being a good player to your DM, getting to know your worlds, adding lore and everything else into it, and also a final topic. This one will be a little bit more, think of it as the home and garden network, but for role-playing games, and that's making a more immersive experience for your games. Yes, guys, I'm even talking about bringing out props and stuff like that to make things a little bit more interesting. So these are some of the topics I'll be covering on Botstroll in the coming weeks and months ahead. So be sure to stay tuned to thisweekingeek.net for more information. So, guys, until next time, I have been your humble host and storyteller and general dork, Mike the Birdman Dodd, saying live free or die hard, and may all your roles be natural 20s.
Okay, son, now you're starting to scare the viewers.
Just act normal.
I'd ask you to do the same, but I'm afraid that ship has sailed.
Why are there so many ostriches?
But you have a game that is dipped in the f-
ropey, thick, window cocking.
So guys, we'll be right back right here on This Week in Geek, only on thisweekingeek.net and many other sites where I syndicate this crap, because I'm a media slut.
I like turtles.
Loose like your mom.
That's right.
No fisting, you say. Anything else you object to?
Me lucky tater tots.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek. Check out our website at thisweekingeek.net for more geek content and subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or any podcatcher. If you'd like to comment on this episode, head to this episode post on thisweekingeek.net and comment through Facebook Connect. Or you can call our voicemail line at 817-717-7202. Follow and message us on Twitter at ThisWeekInGeek. And check out our Instagram at twig_official_podcast. And if you're the good old-fashioned email type, send us an email at feedback@thisweekingeek.net. We'll see you next time. And remember,
lower your shields and surrender your listenership.
When you call 811 before you start a digging project to mark underground infrastructure, you're not just making sure that your dig site is safe. You're making sure that your neighborhood's lights will stay on and that you're preventing gas leaks. Because when you ensure that your digging won't interfere with any of Orange and Rockland's underground gas and electric lines, you're ensuring safety for yourself and your community. Call 811 before you dig, not 911 after. It's the law. Learn more at oru.com/811. Orange and Rockland. Everything matters.
Johnny got a toy golf set when he was 3, and from that day on, he was hooked. All he wanted to do was golf, golf, golf. He'd be on the links before school, after school. All he ever wanted was to go pro. And then, one day, when he was holding his grandson and thinking about his 12 handicap, Johnny realized it just might not happen for him. But you know what did happen for him? He switched to GEICO and saved a bunch of money on car insurance. So that was good, and so was hanging out with his grandson.